Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I am your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today on episode 110, Dr. Will Park and I discuss articles from the June 2018 issue of Retinal Physician, published in print and online at www.retinalphysician.com. Articles discussed cover topics such as managing coexisting anterior and posterior segment conditions, Eales disease, co-managing uveitis, and secondary intraocular lens techniques. As my separate shameless plug, anyone who is attending this year's American Society of Retinal Specialists annual meeting in Vancouver, I would like to personally invite you to please try and attend our first ever social media and online content for ophthalmologists instructional course. Dr. Sunir Garg, Charlie Wyckoff, David Almeida, Anja Curry, and I will be doing a 75-minute course on Friday, July 20th, starting at 1 p.m. For more details, feel free to contact me directly. This should be hopefully informational, but approachable and relaxed, and we hope to continue this tradition in the years coming. So please try to swing by if you have time. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be rejoined by Dr. Will Park from Minneapolis, Minnesota, part of Vitreoretinal Surgery PA. He's here with me to discuss the upcoming June issue of Retinal Physician. We're recording this in advance. This issue will be released online at retinalphysician.com on June 1st. Will, good morning. How are you?
I'm great. Good morning, Jay. Thanks for having me.
So this is great for you because you get solo time. This is your first, I think it's your first solo appearance, right? You get maximum stage time or audio time, whatever you want to call it.
But I have no Ajay, safety blanket here, so it's a little unnerving.
It is unnerving. The less people you have, the more chance that you misread something. I misread something and it's not caught by somebody before I say something dumb. So let's do this. So we picked out a handful of articles. So again, the goal of this for the listeners, we're not going to just summarize the articles. It's a little different than our journal club articles. These are non-journal club type articles, kind of reviews or cases. But it's designed to kind of drive our conversation here and some discussion. And if you hear like what you listen or you want to learn more about what you hear here on the program, then you can go read the articles online. So the first article we're going to discuss is called Managing Coexisting Anterior and Posterior Conditions, with the subtitle Timing is Key. And this was written by one of the contributing writers with various inputs from different surgeons across the country, both retina specialists and I think comprehensive ophthalmologists. So some questions that I derived while reading this, because they kind of go in through various issues. So the first issue, Will, which is a common thing we've talked about before, is how do you get referrals from cataract surgeons for patients with coexisting macular disease and significant cataracts, or you see a patient for primary referral of a macular disease, but they have a visually significant cataract. How does your approach differ for AMD, DME, and RVO, if it does differ? And when do you get these patients to surgery if they're getting injections?
I like the article, and I agree with everything in it, and they kind of stated pretty clearly that among most of the authors in the article, I think the opinion was, and I agree with this, that diabetic macular edema should perhaps be treated a little bit differently and more aggressively before cataract surgery, if possible, than other maculopathies like retinal vein occlusions or AMD. I've seen edema from any of these conditions get a little worse after cataract surgery, but DME seems to be particularly susceptible to it, and so I think treating that aggressively beforehand is helpful. On the other hand, some of these patients, you won't be able to get perfectly stable for a long period of time, and certainly cataract surgery helps both the patient and the doctor in terms of improving their vision and improving your capacity to examine the back of the eye. So if I can't get it perfectly well controlled after a few months, I'll just keep them on intense therapy and just send them for the cataract in between the injections.
Right. Diabetes is interesting because some of these patients, it's part of it's our view to evaluate the extent of the disease, and part of it also is their functional status. It's something we both saw in training. And if you have a patient who has a significant cataract, an example, proliferative diabetic retinopathy, which is severe enough you think warrants laser therapy, I think sometimes that can limit your ability either to get all the laser in, or the patient again is just not functional and you have to do multiple sessions of laser and you're not really making visual progression in terms of their acuity.
Yeah, and the other The other thing about diabetics in general, and you don't want to paint too broad a brush, but in general, compliance is a little more of a challenge with diabetics than with others. And so if you're asking them to come in for a monthly injection and a whole bunch of laser and they're not seeing any visual improvement because their cataract's in the way, you have a higher risk of having them lost to follow-up. Whereas if you can give them, sprinkle in the cataract surgery at, you know, month three or four, and they notice some improvement from that, it helps engage them a little more.
What do you do? So what do you tell the anterior segment surgeon when you, so for example, if I send a patient, one of my colleagues here, I'll be like, hey, you know, get them back to me no more than a month after surgery with, we'll get an OCT and do an exam. Do you have a similar timing approach, or do you want to see them even earlier than that?
I just keep my intervals steady. So whatever my interval that I've found myself comfortable with, 4 weeks or 6 weeks or 8 weeks, I just keep that fixed and then just have them do the surgery in the middle.
Yeah, the other thing they mentioned was they looked at patients who had developed cataracts while receiving steroids, for example, the dexamethasone implant or Ozurdex. Some of these diabetics will need kind of a long-acting steroids to control their diabetic macular edema. And the other issue is they brought up was, you know, maybe some of these patients will also have an epiretinal membrane. Maybe they will actually benefit from surgery. First of all, Will, how, this is a kind of off-topic question, but how often are you, do you think you're percentage-wise using a steroid for DME? When do you like to use a steroid for DME? And then does that adjust your timing of surgery or what you recommend?
I don't use a whole bunch of it, so I may not be the best person to ask the question about the appropriate timing of it. I do use Ozurdex for DME, but not, I don't know the percentage, but it's low. And I certainly would have no problem with doing it preoperatively. But to be honest, I can't recall a recent case of a patient where I was doing a perioperative Ozurdex. Usually, it just ends up being perioperative anti-VEGF for me. But your other question about the ERM in diabetics is an interesting one, and I'm curious what you do about this. Epiretinal membrane and cataract surgery to me is still a pretty big puzzle. And in the article, they were talking about just patients with regular epiretinal membranes doing preoperative steroid or a longer course of perioperative topical NSAIDs, or whether those things should be removed in conjunction with or before cataract surgery. I know our group has looked at the rate of CME in our own patients after cataract surgery as compared to combined surgery, as compared to vitrectomy first and cataract surgery. Do you have a strong opinion on that?
So that's a really good question. And I think, like you said, this is an area of discussion because there's not clear evidence. If there was, we would all kind of do the same thing. The second thing you were asking, I'll address that first, was the medication issue about whether I do a long course of non-steroidals or steroids, either preoperatively or postoperatively. And, you know, I studied at the Carl Regillo School of ERM peeling, and you know, he showed all these great examples, I remember, when I was a fellow, of the edema that you see. It depends what the edema looks like post-peel. And if you're really concerned, you can actually get an angiogram and look to see how much of this is actual leakage versus just residual thickening after removing the membrane that will take time to resolve afterwards. I think it's an interesting concept. I usually don't keep them on non-steroidals for long periods of time. I found that if they don't really have cystoid changes, if it's just thickening, if you just kind of wait, it takes a long time. By long time, I mean months, and I tell those patients that preoperatively. But the thickening will improve, and the contour will tend to improve over time. It's just a time-dependent thing, and my limited experience and then what I saw in training. To your first point,
and to clarify, you're talking about vitrectomy. Just to clarify,
I'm talking about for vitrectomy for ERM. So when you peel the ERM afterward, how aggressively to manage the macular edema? I think most of those cases, it's not actually true macular edema. It's just a structural issue, not a dynamic issue with leakage or something that'd be affected by a non-steroidal or steroid. Though I don't think there are disadvantages to trying that if you wanted to. Regarding the timing, I struggle with this too, and I've gone back and forth. It really depends how significant their cataract is. And it depends sometimes, this is a little unique because of where we are, about where the patient lives. So some of our patients, you know, they live abroad or they live in the Caribbean. It's hard for them to come multiple times for surgeries. And so in those cases, I'm more likely to offer and be like, look, one of the options is to do a combined, you know, phaco vitrectomy and take care of both these problems at the same time. Otherwise, if the cataract is not significant, I usually would just do the vitrectomy for the ERM. If there are any questions, which one is actually the significant issue? And again, my bias based on being taught was to have them have the cataract done first, because sometimes you may think an ERM is significant, but they'll get cataract surgery and then be happy with their vision. And maybe you don't need to do ERM surgery in that patient, expose them to a little more risk than you would with cataract surgery.
Yeah, and you know, and the other thing I think that cataract surgeons sometimes appreciate is, you know, they have very busy practices, and they may get a patient that comes from us that's had a vitrectomy 3 months or 6 months or a year previously, and they don't know all the details of the vitrectomy and what it was for and what the macula looked like. And so if I feel like the patient would benefit from perioperative aggressive anti-inflammation around cataract surgery, certainly to emphasize that in my referral note, just say, you know, oh, hey, this guy's coming to you for cataract surgery. I did a pucker 9 months ago. I think he may be more prone than others to seeing me, you know, prolong your NSAID use. And I think that is generally a helpful thing for them.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that's also very helpful, I try to keep track of this when I chart, and it's a little different because we have kind of multi-specialties within academic practice operate at the same EMR, but the principle could apply to if you're sending notes to another practice, is I always try to document what the preoperative vision was and try to track that, because otherwise it's really hard to remember that and look back in your notes. So like post-op day one, when I write my first post-op day one note, let's say it's a detachment MAC off RD, I'll say, you know, post-op day one surgery, this was the surgery done for a macula-involving RD, and I'll put in parentheses, preoperative vision was X. And I'll just keep that so it keeps circulating in my notes, because you can lose sight of that. Patient has multiple procedures. They have this, they have that. Some, at the end, you always want to kind of keep track of where is kind of the patient's lowest vision, because that's important for the cataract surgeon to know when they're counseling this patient, like you said, and for their own expectations of what the visual acuity potential is after removing the cataract.
That's a great point. I have one other question for you. They briefly comment on silicone oil removal,
right?
And when to take it out, and when it's appropriate to be left in for long periods of time or indefinitely. And I am curious. I have not done much or sent much patients for cataract surgery when oil is present in the back of the eye. Have you done that? Have you had cataract removed while oil is back there?
No, you know, again, this is my bias. I've always had them both done at the same time. I think that you could, I think it's, and this is controversial, I think you could do any of those ways. They're all correct, and you could do them well in every way. I think it's, if you do the oil removal without removing the cataract, I do think there's a chance you may not get all the oil, because some of it may be stuck to the posterior capsule, and you may not be able to get all of it out. You can do the cataract, and I know a lot of practices will refer the patient for the cataract before taking the oil out. In fact, I'm on standby today, in fact, for a case where oil was placed by an outside provider. They didn't really want to remove it, the cataract significant. So one of our surgeons is doing the cataract removal, and I'm on standby in case the oil comes forward or there's any issue to address the back part of the eye. But that's unusual. My question for you, Will, which is something that people in our field debate, is this is not really what they talked about, but if you have to do the cataract and the oil removal at the same time, what is your surgical day plan? Do you first take the oil out and then clamp the infusion and do your cataract surgery? Or do you do the cataract surgery and then remove the oil afterward if you're doing it at the same time?
I do it the first way. I've never tried to take cataract out when oil's in the back of the eye. It looks fun, but I've never done it.
So
I always take the oil out first.
So this is a leading question, because it's very interesting, because I think it reflects where people trained. And I think if you look at, I kind of did an informal survey. We had an ill email thread going around a while back where people kind of try to get a sense of what people did. If you look at the people of our generation nationally, it was probably like 80-20 or 75-25. Most people do it the way you described. It's interesting because when I was in training, and this is my bias, is we always did the phaco and then took the oil out. And the anterior segment surgeons at Wills that I would talk to, many of them preferred, if there was a common case, they would prefer to do the cataract with the oil in. And their reasoning was, there's pros and cons each way, but one was that the bag was less floppy with the oil in there, so it tended to actually kind of be more stabilized. And two, even if you clamp the infusion after removing the oil, the chamber tend to hyper deepen as you did the phaco. And next thing you're kind of really operating, especially if they're a high myope, in kind of this pit, and your angles and your fluidics are all off. So in general, I actually have if I'm operating the fellow, I have them do the phaco first. The one pearl one of my attendings had, because people can be concerned if the oil comes forward, the eye will get soft, is she would just say, just if you want, you can put a single valve trocar in inferiorly. You don't necessarily have to hook up the infusion, or you can hook up the infusion, just not open it. And that way, if you do have oil come forward at some point, you can just, you have that access point where the eye will never really get soft, and you can pressurize the eye.
That's a great point. I should also, you should also clarify to your listeners that that survey that you sent around involved me and a number of other people of my ilk, so you could probably throw out the data. It's probably not very useful.
It was as anecdotal as I made it sound really, really scientific. It was super anecdotal data. You know, the last thing that was discussed is, and again, we're going to take this off in a direction, but was talking about high myopia, screening for retinal detachment. I'm going to ask you a different question, which is, again, something has been discussed here before, but I'm curious about what you do. So what do you do for the patient who, let's say it's a young patient who had a retinal detachment related to lattice or atrophic holes, and the other eye has extensive lattice or and or holes? Let's say they're in their 20s. You know, let's say it's a patient that you did a primary buckle on for that eye, and they repaired successfully, but they were macula involving. So really the good eye is the other eye. Do you do ever recommend prophylactic laser for those patients? And what kind of plays in your decision-making about when to offer that versus when to observe and how to watch those patients?
Let me think. So obviously the hyaloid status matters, but if they're young, it's probably attached still. And the if it's difficult for them to access quick medical care, they're going internationally a lot, or they live somewhere rural or something like that, or they have what looks to me to be high risk lattice. It's kind of an arbitrary distinction, but you know, a lot of it, or it looks very pronounced, or they want it, I do it. I offer it. I just say, you know what, this, it may reduce the risk a little bit of another detachment, and I offer it. I say, on the other hand, if you'd prefer to leave it alone, I'm happy to just, you know, be watching you closely. I'm kind of soft on it, but the people I really want to do it on, people who have difficulty coming in from really rural areas. So I do it on them.
That's a really good point.
How about you?
It's similar for me. I think it's interesting. Again, this is geographic trends. I think when I was up north, any patient or many patients who had a detachment with one eye that was repaired, and any lattice in the other eye, it would be treated. And then that is not the case down here at Bascom Palmer. I think that just reflects different schools of thought. A lot of the teaching we got was data we've talked about with like Norm Byers' data and some of the papers where the relative risk of a detachment for an atrophic hole or lattice was extremely low. And you know, whether laser actually may not help that risk, or if done incorrectly or done in a way, maybe not incorrectly, but if you're not able to do it in the optimal fashion, maybe increase that risk, is also something that's controversial. So yeah, I do the same thing. I think if it's quote unquote high risk, or it looks high risk, I think if it's less extensive sometimes, maybe like if and that's just because it may be technically easier to get the laser in if it's, you know, some isolated patches versus just lattice everywhere, and then you're basically just barricading, which I don't love doing. And then access to care. If it's a patient who is a young person who's like, hey, I'm going to be in the Peace Corps for 2 years and I'm not going to be, you know, anywhere near a doctor, then maybe you consider doing something, versus someone who is a little more type A, is willing to come in, is very, you know, conscious of their symptoms, then I'm willing to watch them. And I'll usually err towards watching versus treating.
You know, and you should point, there is some data out there that it reduces the risk in the fellow eye. I think there's a UCLA study that indicates that, but you're right, there's not a lot of data that it helps. But I'm sure you've seen a number of these cases. I certainly have, of patients who've had prophylactic laser for lattice, and then they detach from a tear that's just adjacent to the prophylactic laser,
right,
in an unsupported area. So I don't know what the right move is.
Well, that takes us into, if we're talking about unknowns, we're going to talk about the next short write-up was about Eales disease, which is a blast from the past, according to the title, a rare but important disease to consider in patients with vasculitis. This was written by one of the excellent residents here, Nandini Venkateshwaran, along with Sonal Dave, who's a former resident from here now in practice in Portland, and Dr. Flynn, Harry Flynn from Bascom Palmer. So
I've heard of him. Yeah.
I've heard rumors of his work. So this was a case description. It was the really most interesting thing was the follow-up over 28 years for this patient, 27 years follow-up here. and then just kind of reviewed the features of Eales disease and the differential diagnosis. So that's all the write-up. The only questions I had for you, Will, so for the listeners, since you are the guru, or you are my guru, for differentials for certain things, when you think of an obliterative vasculitis, what is immediately the things that come to mind? What sort of things should you be thinking about if you're a retina fellow?
So it's nice to, and I'm certainly not Ephraim Mandelkorn, so I'm sure he has like a catchy little song about it that has like 10 times the differential that I have. it's nice if you can to kind of identify whether it's predominantly a venous process or arterial process. And sometimes that can be determined, sometimes it can't. But for a peripheral venous process, or peripheral vascular process in general with ischemia and vascular leakage and inflammation, I think it's important not to forget diabetes. Diabetes can still do this. You can have very peripheral, very dramatic ischemic diabetes that looks a lot like Eales or sickle or something else like that. In the inflammatory spectrum, Eales, TB, the syphilis, Lyme, like the article was indicating, I've seen MS do it as well, and sarcoidosis, of course, with periphlebitis, and then sickle retinopathy, and I've always heard of radiation doing this. So I've never actually seen radiation retinopathy do only peripheral that looked like this, but I'm sure it can. The ANCA positive study, so the granulomatous inflammatory conditions. I just kind of do a basic uveitic workup plus, you know, if it's indicated, a sickle evaluation and target those specific entities.
Yeah, Behçet's is another one. And then one you taught me about, which is extremely...
Behçet, of course, yeah.
And
lupus.
Lupus, and then extremely uncommon. You have to think about weird things too sometimes, like an extremely uncommon, like Irvan, which is something you taught me about, with idiopathic retinitis, vasculitis, aneurysms, and neuroretinitis. Eales disease is kind of... go ahead.
I was going to say that I have not seen a lot of Irvan, but the Irvan I've seen, it usually looks pretty characteristic. And the nerve aspect of Irvan is relatively dramatic, but I have not seen a lot of it. But yeah, that's a great one to keep on your list.
One of the things they emphasize, Eales disease is a diagnosis of exclusion, right? So someone listening to this shouldn't be like, oh, you know, next patient I see, definitely Eales disease. Eales disease is very rare. And it's still unclear why it happens. And my question, again, this is a general question. You referenced doing the uveitis workup. At what point are you referring this patient as a retina specialist out in practice? Do you do the workup? Do angiogram, get yourself a more refined differential, maybe a tentative diagnosis, and then refer them? Or do you...
Coming to a uveitis specialist?
Mm-hmm. Like, what do you do personally?
I don't think I would refer... We usually handle our own uveitis. The exception that would be if it was, I mean, obviously I involve rheumatology depending on the diagnosis, but I don't think I would use a uveitis specialist unless they were not responding the way I expected them to therapy and something unusual is happening. But in general, I think it would be nice for the uveitis specialist to, if you're going to refer to uveitis, I'd get your baseline lab work, I suppose, and perhaps start initial therapy if you feel comfortable doing it, and then send them.
Yeah, and that's how
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't really know when to refer the uveitis specialist.
I think, you know, the next article is co-management of uveitis patients by Pauline Merrill and Elizabeth Atchison from Rush University. This isn't really addressed here about when to refer these patients. I think that's just so variable when I talk to people throughout the country. I think that depends about your personal comfort level. I think it depends on your practice. I think it depends on what's available. You know, if your office is two doors down from Janet Davis or Tom Albini, then your referral patterns are going to be different than if the uveitis specialist is 200 miles away. I think it's just really variable. Well, I think for many people, once you start talking about starting anti-metabolites or long-term immune suppression, they either want a rheumatologist or a uveitis specialist on board. Go ahead.
And certainly getting rheumatology involved early if you're going to be co-managing the medicines with them is obviously critical. And it helps to have a good relationship with rheumatology and be talking to them on the phone about these patients, because Your little EMR notes usually don't do the job. And I think just kind of, I'll let you get back to that, but just briefly skipping ahead to that, that article's comment on it. I think that rheumatologists are very eager to help in this scenario, but just need a lot of information from you. So just telling them exactly what your endpoints are and where the patient stands and what medicines you think they'll respond well to, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. And I think rheumatology, a lot of times, information is so important for them. We assume that they're just going to get a lab workup and come up with a diagnosis, but a lot of the rheumatologic conditions, it's not simply just like a blood test, right? It's a constellation of symptoms or findings, and for the eye findings, they're relying on us to tell them, hey, is this, you know, uveitis, is scleritis, what kind of inflammation is this? Just like it would be difficult for us to tell them or know this patient's rheumatoid arthritis is X type involving this joint, and you know, we don't have that information. They need to communicate with us. I mean, the other specialists that were mentioned in this article to communicate with, pulmonologists for sarcoidosis, infectious disease patients for infectious uveitis like syphilis, primary care for when you put patients on steroids, and then, you know, cataract surgeons, glaucoma doctors, just for monitoring for cataracts and glaucoma. It could be tricky to coordinate. And I mean, do you have good standardized ways in your practice to remember, or have your, if you have a scribe, have notes sent to the people, making sure they get sent properly, and that things are kept kind of A, efficient for you, so you don't have to constantly be reviewing it, and B, consistent, so that you have these letters going out?
Yeah, we have the letters go out on complex patients on a per visit basis to the entirety of their you know, medical team, but I still will dictate a separate letter to the rheumatologist or whoever the specialist is with a little bit more fleshed out story on a you know, intermittent basis based on, you know, what's changing on the eye. And by the thing about the primary care doctors is an excellent point. And that article mentioned that just reminded us all that steroids increase the risk of heart attack and stroke in these patients. And so it's getting the primary care team involved with steroid therapy is important as well. That's a great point.
The last article we'll discuss was actually by my former co-fellow, Ali Khan. It's called Management Options for Dislocated Intraocular Lenses. Retinal surgeons can choose from a variety of techniques. And this is a very good review of kind of all the different non-ACIOL options available, or the most a few of them that there are options, including the Gore-Tex sutured lenses and the different lenses you can use with that. Sutureless scleral fixation, including both a trocar cannula technique as well as the Yamane double needle technique, and then kind of reviewing what was available in terms of the literature and comparisons, and then the sort of things that maybe we should think about when deciding which IOL options to consider for a patient who needs a secondary IOL. So every surgeon is different, and we're all biased by where we trained and what we're exposed to and what we're comfortable with. General rules, Will, like when you see a patient, when are you thinking ACIOL versus a different secondary lens?
First of all, I'm very excited to sit back and like just take a back seat and listen to you about the Acrios things. I've never done one of those. I'm really interested in your experience with them. I think I try to approach it still for me, especially in older patients, as a ACIOL first, and try to think of a reason not to do it just because it's so reliable. That's changing a little bit for me. I'm doing more and more of the trocar assisted scleral fixation technique. But certainly if they're, you know, older and they have good sclera and there's no reason you can't do a tunnel and they don't have any history of uveitis or they're not prone to see me in any particular fashion and you just want to be done with the surgery, then I think the ACIOL is great. But for instance, I did a scleral fixated on a bird shot patient with a dislocated IOL last week who's been, her bird shot control has been pretty tenuous, and we felt that the AC lens would just be a little bit too aggravating for her in terms of the surgery itself and the postoperative inflammation. So I did a trocar fixated one on that patient, and then young patients, I do the trocar fixated ones a lot. And the one thing I'll comment on is in the article they were talking about, and this is a fantastic article by Ali, it's saying that that part of the decision is made by whether you're going to use the lens that's already dislocated within the eye. If there's a three-piece lens that's dislocated in the back of the eye, using that same lens. And I think that's a great technique and certainly something I'd consider if for some reason I really didn't want to spend the time to exchange it. But even then, I still exchange all those. I just don't feel good enough about the IOL that's dislocated to reuse it. So I take it out and put a new one in, which usually isn't that big a deal, but perhaps that takes away one of the potential advantages of the scroll fixated technique, which is that advantage of using the lens that's already in the eye.
Yeah, so I'm going to, and before I get into Gore-Tex lenses, which I will not claim to be an expert in, but I'll share what I can, I'm going to ask you about suture, the trocar assist technique, because that's one actually that I have not done. And one of the reasons is I don't think I've had a dislocated three-piece IOL. A lot of the IOLs I'll do will be like one-piece IOLs or sometimes these really old PMMA optics. And then if I'm taking it out, I'll usually just put a Gore-Tex in because I'm faster and comfortable with that. But you know, my question for that technique, because when I was reading, he kind of summarized the data from their big series from Beaumont. The most common postoperative complication was vitreous hemorrhage in 22% of eyes, CME in 21% of the eyes. And 10% of eyes needed another surgery. And I'm sure that decreases over time as you get more and more comfortable with this technique. This is one of those things where it looks very easy on videos, and then everyone I talk to is like, you know, the first couple times you do it, it's actually harder than you think. You know, people say it's easier to use like the Aaron Scientific lens, but again, if you're trying to use the lens that's in the eye, that often is not that. It may often be like an MA60 with more fragile haptics. Any tips, pearls, things you've learned from doing it? Any accounting for that vitreous hemorrhage thing? Is that just from maybe ciliary body trauma as you're externalizing the haptics?
Yeah, I assume that is. I confess I haven't seen that, but I'm not crediting myself for that. Maybe I just got lucky so far. But I think you obviously do a good vitreous-based dissection. Mark Walsh taught me this. I don't go 2 millimeters back. I go about 1.5 millimeters back, and maybe I'm
interesting.
Putting a little less. The thought behind that is just putting a little less tension on the optic-haptic junction by having just a little bit further anterior. I've never had an iris issue where it rubbed on the iris. So I think as long as...
My question, did he advise you to change your IOL calculations based on moving that?
You know, he didn't. I don't want to misquote Mark, but I think he basically just has his anterior segment colleagues in the community weigh in terms of the IOL calcs. I don't have that luxury, so I basically just do my best with the calcs. I feel like I'm reasonably accurate in terms of being usually a little bit minus, which is what I shoot for with them. But I just do the in the bag measurements, so I don't alter the in the bag IOL calculations.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. That makes sense. That seems for Gore-Tex.
Yeah, and it seems to work fine. I have trouble about every, just when I think I'm getting good at this type of surgery, I have trouble about every 10th case or 12th case or so with this. So I certainly agree that it's not the easiest technique in the world, even though the videos make it look very elegant. And my only, I have a couple points that would be obvious to somebody like you who've, would immediately realize that the needless list of my early learning curve with this one. But you want to put those 27 gauge trocars in before you make your corneal wound, because not only does it make it harder to put them in, but also the angle usually is a little bit suboptimal with those, and the measurements are a little bit off if the eye is softening up with an open corneal wound. So putting in the 27 gauge trocars early to get them so they're very precisely 1.5 or 2 millimeters back from the limbus, exactly 180 degrees apart, with a nice long tunnel is advantageous. And then the hardest part to me is always getting the first haptic into the inferior trocar. I know this is a kind of tough thing to talk about on a podcast, but some people just drop the IOL to the back of the eye and just pick it up off the macula, which works fine. What I generally do is I basically put the IOL half in the eye so that the trailing haptic is still outside the corneal wound, and then I flip the IOL perpendicular to the cornea. Sticking through the pupil, so it flips the haptic, so it's the tip of the haptic's facing me,
kind
of
pointing,
and then I can visualize it better, but that's the hardest part, is getting that first one into the trocar. And then the last thing that I've noticed is I've had two cases where even though these are 27 gauge trocars and 27 gauge max grip forceps that I'm using, and I pull the haptic out and I cauterize the bulb or create the little flange at the end, and I stick it back in the tunnel, I've had two cases where nonetheless the haptic intraoperatively migrated back into the eye, even though there was a bulb on the end. And so I had to go grab it again with the max grip, pull it out, and make a bigger bulb. So just something that I was surprised by, but has happened twice to me. So intraoperatively, it's been a little bit of an adventure for me. Postoperatively, they've done well, thankfully, but certainly some of them can be pretty slow cases.
Yeah, I think we'd all agree that you'd rather have a long intraoperative denture than have a postoperative problem.
That's true.
So it's better for the patient, better for you. But the Acrios is similar, right? So it is actually, I think, technically not difficult. And from a conceptual standpoint, right, you have either a lens that has four eyelets, like the Acrios AO60, which is or classically described, or now people are using the Envista MX60, which is actually an IOL that has kind of eyelets near the optic that you thread through. I personally done the Envista, but a lot of my colleagues and former colleagues from Wills are doing that now in cases where they're worried about. Go ahead.
Oh no, I was going to say, so that one doesn't do the air opacification,
right?
Thing
so
you always worry about.
Yeah, so they're in cases where they're worried that it may opacify, or some of them are doing it routinely because it's like, well, you never know if they're going to get a detachment, so I'm not going to use the AO60. I mean, I'm biased, but my thing about the AO60 is unless you're extremely worried about you getting a detachment afterwards, you get a good vitreous shave, they don't have a history of pre-existing pathology, they don't have significant pathology posteriorly, you know, you've treated everything you need to treat and a good peripheral exam. I still like the AO60 a lot. I think it's just the four eyelets give you a nice four-point fixation, and it's one of those things, again, it is theoretically very simple. You're threading these out of the eye at four different points and then just tying them down, usually nasally and temporally. It can be very simple, and if you mess a couple things up en route, it could be extremely painful. Just my pearls would be, I think you kind of referenced this, setting up everything before you enter the eye is really helpful. So I actually take the longest time just with the setup when I'm teaching the fellows, which setup, I mean, mark where, 3 and 9 o'clock, it doesn't have to be exactly 3 and 9 o'clock, but 180 degrees you mark with like a toric marker, conjunctival peritomies on either end. You can do this transconjunctival, and we wrote up that technique, but I still prefer to make peritomies to make sure I cover the knots completely and there's no conj defects over it. Cotter's in the bed, so you have the sclera, so you don't have a lot of bleeding in the areas where you're going to be trying to manipulate suture out of the sclera. And then the measurements, I like 3 millimeters posterior to limbus and 5 millimeters apart, so the lens hangs back a little bit. And then I usually do this either 25 or 27 gauge. If I'm taking an IOL out or doing any sort of significant intraoperative work, I like 25 more because it tends to be a little more forgiving if you need to torque or move things within the eye. 27 is nice if they're completely aphakic and you just want to put a lens in, it will minimize your leakage after. But 25 tends not to leak much either. And then setting up all of that and then putting your infusion in and for example, if you're thinking you're going to make a tunnel to take out a big lens, I pre-place my tunnel without opening it. I'll just make the whole tunnel but not enter the eye. So everything is ready to go. And then going back there, if there's a lens taking it up, delivering the AC, one thing I've tried to reinforce to my fellows and have tried to reinforce to myself is just not forgetting that to protect the cornea, and you're going to have viscoelastic in to protect the cornea, but you may lose some of it. And just to keep remembering to kind of reinflate and keep that cornea protected, because I do think that where this technique can fall under criticism relative to ACIOL proponents is that it can be extremely traumatic to the cornea if you're not careful in terms of taking an IOL out. And then once you have the IOL out in terms of getting the lens in, I like to I thread the lens on the field. Some people here have actually started marking so you just really just don't want to mix up your sutures. You want your sutures to be very well positioned, that you know which suture is going to go out of which opening in the sclera. And then, so some people here have started marking, like they'll put a little marking pen on the inferior ones, for example, so they won't mix those up. And then I externalize usually 3 of the sutures. I think 3 is nice because the lens then can't flip when you fold it and put it in the eye. Fold the lens. It fits through like a 3.25 or 3.5 millimeter incision, which is kind of like a three-piece IOL excision, which is nice. And then dunking the lens in and then externalizing the last suture. And then the last thing I do before I suture anything down is I use a Kuglin or a hook, and I kind of pull on one side to tilt the lens to one side, push the iris, and I'll check nasally, for example, where the sutures are. Are they going through? Do they look good? Is everything straight? Nothing crossed? Nothing looped? I'll do it on the other side. Ali's, again, he's taught me a lot of this over time because he has a ton of experience doing these due to his time in residency. The other thing he always talks about is good visualization. Like if you need to put hooks, I have a low, very low threshold in these cases now to put hooks, and just so I can really see what's going on out there. And then try to remove as much as the anterior vitreous, capsule, remnants, anything that will get in the way of this lens. And then not over-tightening those sutures and kind of going back and forth between the two sides in terms of the tightness so it centers well. Make sure the knot's buried. 25, 20 tends to bury easily. 27 can be a little trickier to bury. And then the rest is just conch coverage and everything. I mean, they look really nice when they close. And usually you need either a mattress suture or two tendo nylons through the corneal incision to get good closure. And the most common thing people ask about is hypotony and how strict you have to be about leakage, because there's probably a little bit of leakage. If you do it right, and you do it, the less you manipulate the sclerotomies, meaning if you don't have to go in and out of the sclerotomies multiple times trying to grab your sutures, the less likely they are to leak. That's kind of a common sense thing, but I've seen it anecdotally too. And so usually two of the sclerotomies have trocars in them and two of them don't. You just make them with the trocar blade. The ones that don't have the trocar blade, usually the inferior ones, those usually don't leak if you don't manipulate them more than once to go in and out. It's the superior ones that tend to leak, and if you rotate the knot into that one, that will help in terms of minimizing leakage. There's, like they described in the series, there's still transient hypotony. It usually would go away in about within a week. And then the last thing I do at the end of the case is before I pull the infusion, I clamp the infusion and let it sit for a couple, like maybe a minute, and then recheck my IOP and just make sure that my eye's not completely soft, that there's a huge leak somewhere that I'm just not appreciating. And if you do need to suture one of the sclerotomies, use an 8-0 BV needle. It's a vascular needle, Vicryl suture. It's a very thin needle, very low risk of engaging or cutting your Gore-Tex suture, and you can carefully suture the sclera around it. But I have not had to do that since I've done primarily 25-gauge. I think the only scenario where you would really have to do that is if it's 25, very myopic, very thin sclera, and they've had multiple surgeries, multiple vitrectomies in the past.
Well, dude, I'm embarrassed that you had so many more tips about your technique than I had about my technique.
Oh, I definitely thought more about this. And, no, but I mean, I'll just tell you that this is from many, many missteps. Like you were referencing, thankfully not as many missteps postoperatively, but so many missteps intraoperatively can happen and make a very simple surgery into a very complex surgery, which is why many people don't like doing these lens cases.
You know, and it's what we'll see how these go. Yeah, I both these techniques look. Obviously, we won't have suture breakage techniques, or at least certainly won't with mine, and almost certainly won't with you, considering the Gore-Tex material. I'm still really curious about internal erosion over time with both of these. You know, in a decade, will the haptic erode internally over time, or will the your Gore-Tex suture erode internally? And I don't know. I guess we'll just find out in 10 years whether we'll be taking all these out and putting in ACI wells.
We'll find out. This podcast may not age well. We'll see.
You may want to take this off your website in a couple of years. But my only last question about that technique is regarding the air thing, which I'm always curious about the air thing, the opacification. Have you seen that at all?
I have personally not seen it, but I've seen cases of it pictured. It's not consistent. So here's the thing. It's not a complete air issue because you expose the lens to air when you open it and you put it in the eye. And it doesn't happen in every case because I know people at some of the corneal surgeons at Wells, they would do DSEC and Gore-Tex, and they put an air bubble in the eye. And so there's air in the eye and it wouldn't opacify. So no one really knows why it happens in certain cases, what the risk for it happening is. There's no consistency to do it. There's not even clear evidence why it happens in these lenses.
And when it happens, is it permanent?
Yeah, so it calcifies. It's actually calcification. When you remove these lenses, look histopathologic. It's calcified. So there's no way to remove it. So that's when you have to explant the IOL and put a new IOL. But again, no one even knows the true rate of this.
Interesting. And was it noted intraoperatively or postoperatively? I'm just curious whether this happens like immediately.
No, it's not immediate. It's usually noted postoperatively. So it's something that happens that changes. It's very interesting. And again, if we could identify, hey, it's patients like with these factors, it happens because of some internal milieu component of their aqueous maybe influences this, that'd be helpful, but we have no idea why. And so when you don't have a good reason for why something happens, sometimes that frightens people or makes them not want to do it. And that's why I think some people prefer to use the Envista. Even though I think if you do it right, it's good, but you don't get that true 4-point fixation because, again, now you have you're using only two holes on each side rather than four.
Interesting. Well, the only last plug I'll give the only last comment I'll give on the scroll fixated trocar technique is that I have not used the the Aaron's flexible haptic one, but I really like that MA50. That optic being bigger gives you a lot bigger cushion, and I think the risk of it having potential iris captured on the road is a lot lower. So I think it's a great lens to use, and I find the haptics perfectly adequate in terms of their pliability for it. So I'd be an advocate for the MA50 for my technique.
Perfect. Well, Will Park, thanks for sharing with us and joining and discussing these articles with me. It's been an absolute pleasure. We may have to do solo again. We got to give you more more audio time. We got to cut Ajay and Ryan.
I don't know, man. I don't know if I can handle the pressure. I may need some support in the background. I like when Ajay's there, so that when I tell a bad joke, you know, I get Ajay's really heartening laugh there. So that's a good thing to have.
At least you get the heartening laugh. Last time I was with him, he gave the "I'm not amused at all," but I'm gonna politely chuckle, and it was very obvious. He was like ha ha ha, and then he just kept talking. So all right, well, you have a great morning, and I'll talk to you soon.
All right, thanks, man. Bye.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 110 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. On the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. There are links on the bottom to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. You can find us on Facebook or in the podcast section of the iTunes Store and Google Play. On Twitter, we're at RetinaPodcast, and to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback about things we can do better and things we are already doing well. We also appreciate anyone who subscribes via iTunes or Google Play to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Dr. Will Park for joining me. Thanks to Jennifer Ford and the rest of the team at PentaVision for providing the content for discussion. Thanks to Louis Kai, Mike Vinicasa, and Angela Chang for producing this great episode. And finally, thank you listeners for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire. This is Jay Schreeder signing off.
Good feeling.
This is straight from the